millions of Americans who still believes that honesty, integrity, and fidelity are the cornerstones of our democracy. We suggest you wait for another preview before getting your popcorn. In the nation's capital, a new leader has found a place in the halls of power. But her story began in the halls of high school.
Move on now to the presidential race with three candidates running. The first is Tracy Flick.
One thing that's important to know about me is that I'm an only child. My mom is really devoted to me. She likes to write letters to successful women like Elizabeth Dole and Connie Chung and ask them what advice do they have for me, Tracy, her daughter.
The next candidate for student body president is Paul Metzler.
I just don't think somebody would do something like that on purpose.
I think you did it.
If you want to keep questioning me like this, I won't continue without my attorney present. I do not often speak with you and ask for things, but now I really must insist that you help me win the election tomorrow, because I deserve it and Paul Metzler doesn't, as you well know.
The final candidate, sophomore Tammy Metzler.
I'm attracted to the person. It's just that all the people I've ever been attracted to happen to be girls.
You should stop her. She's not qualified.
We can't both run, can we? I mean, we're brother and sister. Can we?
Tracy and I are totally in love.
In love?
Yeah.
So is this a moral situation or an ethical situation?
When I win the presidency, that means you and I are going to be spending a lot of time together.
Cast your vote for Tracy Flick next week. You won't just be voting for me. You'll be voting for yourself.
Who knew how high she would climb in life? I had to stop her.
Excuse me! Will you please be quiet?
Now.
Paramount Pictures presents an MTV Films production.
Order! Order!
Starring Matthew Broderick. Oh. Reese Witherspoon.
Hey, what happened to your eye?
What happened to your eye? Are you okay, Miss McAllister?
I'm fine.
On the road to greatness. Never underestimate an overachiever.
Looks like you could use a cupcake.
Election. Cast your vote.
And welcome to the Cult Cinema Circle podcast. My name is Jesse, and I'll be your host. Now, on today's episode, we're going to head out and do our due diligence and make our voices heard. And we're going to go out and vote for student body president, I guess. But you know what? We're also going to go behind the scenes a little bit and just see how messy and dramatic it all is behind the scenes. But today, we are going to be covering a little movie from 1999 that is going to be celebrating its 25th year anniversary this year. It's a little movie called Election. But for this movie, though, I couldn't do it alone by myself. I had to bring in a guest for this. And the reason I wanted to bring this guest on was because I saw this is a movie that they really, really enjoy. And I thought, why the hell not bring them on and chop it up about this film? So he is a founding member of the Horror Queers Book Club, who has bylines at Philadelphia Row Home Magazine, Philadelphia Magazine, Philadelphia Gay News, We Live Entertainment, and has written scripts for some of your favorite anime favorites at Funimation Entertainment and Crunchyroll, and also has been featured on the podcasts Scarred for Life, Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, Consider This, and also the Horror Queers podcast. But please welcome to my show, Mr. Justin Nordell. Justin, how are you doing today?
Thank you so much for having me. I am so ready to join this cult. Pass me the Kool-Aid. Let's go.
Oh, yes, yes. We're a nice cult like that. But yeah, you might get a little bit of a fun Kool-Aid tropical Hawaiian punch shit. You know, it'll be good. But yeah, but thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Give me fruity.
Of course. Fruity for the fruits.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I love this film. I love this book. And I am so excited to talk about it with you.
Oh, yes, of course. So, yeah, I want to talk a little bit. I heard you for the first time on actually the Horror Queers podcast. I heard you talk about Funny Games, which actually it also prompted me to watch that movie. And the movie is deeply disturbing, but deeply beautiful in some sort of way, and I really like it. So, like, don't own it yet, but it's on the Criterion list. It may be ended up in my collection sometime. Yeah, and so I remember you from that. I think I might have started your episode on Scarred for Life. Shout out Terry and Mary Beth. You know, so that's always a super fun pod to listen to. And then, of course, also you're a PA boy, at least. So you live there in Philadelphia, of course. So that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I'm from Baltimore. So I also think it's funny, and I will say this too. It might just be because you do have like a journalistic background a little bit as well, where you have published and all. I feel like you've seen every single goddamn movie in the world, because I follow you in Letterboxd, and you just have a rating for every movie, it seems like. So I'm like, God damn, bitch, like, how do you watch all these things? But that's kind of why I wanted to bring you on for this.
I will actually come clean on your podcast. I have a genetic thing on my mom's side of the family. I have some cousins and aunts who are the same way. I actually only need 4 hours of sleep a night to function, and I am a completely fully functioning human being. If I get more than 6, it's like I'm drunk. Like, that's too much sleep for me. So I genuinely fully functionally operate on 4 hours of sleep a night. So when people are like, oh, I wish I had more hours in the day, I literally do. And I spend those hours usually reading and or watching movies, watching films, because my husband is a spectacular human being who I love immensely. However, not a big movie person, and he will aggressively fall asleep in even the best films. So there are many, many times where, you know, there's something that I want to watch and I'll put it on and he'll be asleep within 5 seconds. And then I'll watch that and other films and so on and so forth. But in all honesty, films have been my babysitter since I was a small child. I used to just get kind of parked in front of the TV and would watch tons and tons of things. My parents divorced at a young age, and my dad would let us go to the video rental store and get whatever we wanted, regardless of rating. And I, you know, of course, pick 3, 4, 5, 6 films for a weekend. My dad would just go, sure, so that, you know, we could be parked in front of the TV and he could go out and about and do whatever. So I have seen well over 18,000 films and counting. And as a critic for Philadelphia Row Home Magazine, I get to see all the wonderful new releases, so I can do my reviews for them. So it's just something that is a huge, huge passion of mine.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I can kind of understand that with your kind of love of movies and everything. I mean, you know, for me, like, I was also somebody who I did not have a whole lot of restrictions as a child in terms of what I watched. So I was definitely watching things that I kind of shouldn't have been, quote unquote, but they have since become something I really appreciate and love. And so that's definitely for me, like, you know, I completely agree with that. Now, I will ask you though too. So this movie for me, in terms of my history with it, I had only really seen it recently, probably within the last 2 years. I did not grow up on this movie. I didn't watch it back in the day or anything like that, but I deeply, deeply love it and enjoy it for what it is. And so what I kind of want to know with you is, like, what is your history with this movie? Like, when did you first see it? You know, what is it about this film would make you want to come on a podcast and, you know, talk about it and dissect it and everything? And I kind of want to know a little bit about that.
Election, I first saw actually in theaters. We have a really wonderful little small independent film theater in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, in the suburbs of Philadelphia, where I grew up, right outside of New Hope. Shout out to the county theater in Doylestown. But they screened Election, and I was somebody who was actively, I believe, either in high school or middle school when this hit theaters. And so I was like, oh, this is a teen movie. And believe it or not, this movie was produced by MTV Films. And they copiously, copiously advertised this movie on MTV. And I had previously seen Reese Witherspoon in a film called The Man in the Moon that I love. It's still to this day one of my favorite performances by her as an actress. And it's a performance that even Siskel and Ebert back in the day called her, you know, the best young rising star, child actress back in 1991 as a result of that. To this day, she's still delivering fantastic performances. But between Reese Witherspoon, Matthew Broderick, I was just really, really excited to see this fun teen movie. Got to the theater, watched it, and oh my God, is it so dark and sardonic and witty and metaphoric. There's so many rich layers to it, and there's so much humor that can be derived depending on kind of who you are, what character you identify with, et cetera, et cetera. So I think Election is just such an exquisitely well-rounded film, and what a time capsule. Then I was able to read the book it was based on, and I really, really enjoyed the novel by Tom Perrotta, who a lot of people might know because he wrote The Leftovers, which was adapted into the HBO series. He also wrote Little Children, which was adapted into the Jennifer Connelly film and Patrick Wilson. And so it's something that, you know, he has had a lot of things in the adaptation pipeline. And this book is just so much lighter and fluffier on first read. And it is pretty true to the film. And we'll go into that later, I'm sure. But there's some really, really great biting satire in it that I really loved and appreciated. And it just kind of emphasize my love of this movie even more. And I also was a huge fan of Citizen Ruth, which came out a couple years before this, which was the first feature-length debut by the director Alexander Payne. And so, you know, knowing that this movie was by him, I was like, oh, well, I've got to see the next Citizen Ruth, and was pleasantly surprised by this one.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you on that, because for me, at least, because this was something that was older that I came back to, you know, recently. But yeah, I mean, this is probably my first exposure to him. And then I was hearing about Citizen Ruth and I finally watched it. And goddamn, like, these two movies, iconic, amazing. I personally feel like Payne has not really done, I wish he would have done more like he did with these two films for my liking, because something like Sideways or, you know, any of his other films, you know, I just don't think they pack the same punch that these two do personally. That's just my opinion, but, you know, it is what it is. I will also say too, Alexander Payne is a rich white man who also signed off on the Roman Polanski contract. Bleh. So, you know,
gross. Yeah, he did make this fantastic. The beginning of his filmography is exquisite. I genuinely love so much of what he worked on as a director, so much of as an executive producer, and genuinely love some of his later stuff. Nebraska with Bruce Dern, if you've never seen it, absolutely lovely, lovely film with a really, really wonderful, just intergenerational relationship story, and incredibly well shot in black and white. The Holdovers, which just came out this past season, and of course had him and some other fantastic people nominated for Oscars. And shout out to Divine Joy Randolph from Philadelphia, who won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for that role. That being said, that film, if you aren't up on the controversy, apparently somebody had given Payne a script that was very, very, very similar to it. And then Alexander Payne said no to that script, not once, but twice. And then had this idea for The Holdovers, please hear my air quotes through the podcast, and then gave the writing duties to someone else and told the writer exactly what he wanted beat for beat. And unfortunately, it is beat for beat, very similar to this film that he read twice and passed on. So very interested to see where and if that lawsuit moves forward. But there's no denying it that Alexander Payne absolutely knew of the story of The Holdovers in its different form from another writer. So interested to see where that goes. And also, let's call a spade. Downsizing is pretty feckin' yucky. Like, there's a lot of moments and bits and that that are just really, really, that it gave us Hong Chau, who is one of my favorite actresses working today, and it gave her a huge platform. But the treatment of that character in that script was really, really icky. And so a lot of just questionable things by this nice old white man from Nebraska who continues to make good films, but also questionable decisions.
Yeah, I agree. To speak on the point about the thing with Frisco, I think that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Sorry. To speak on that, so it's interesting to see how that lawsuit will go. I don't think it holds any weight. And the reason I think it doesn't hold any weight is because there was a fantastic analysis video from a YouTuber by the name of Jane Mulcaney, I believe, went to school in, I think, London. And I think she lives in like the Midwest somewhere. And she actually talked about how delusional the guy who did Frisco is, and how really a lot of what he is claiming was stolen from him is down and out really delusional at this point. So was The Holdovers, which I'm still planning to watch on Peacock at some point, was it plagiarized? I would personally say, from the information I've gathered from at least that video, probably not. However, like, it's one of those things where,
and I agree. You know,
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like you can't you can't copyright an idea. Okay, it's kind of hard to like.
Right. And that being said, I mean, this happens all the time, and the number of lawsuits in Hollywood when it comes to scripts that are similar to other scripts or took ideas from other scripts that have actually come to lawsuits and actually come to payouts, like literally less than 10 in the history of the Writers Guild of America. It is really, really hard to actually get that anywhere. And yes, the more you read about him, the more you're like, oh, okay. But that being said, Alexander Payne does have a number of moments throughout his career that we do have to acknowledge. But that being said, again, I just am in love with his early filmography and just really, really genuinely love this movie Election.
Yeah, no, totally. I agree. Absolutely. Getting off our soapbox now. It's all good. But yeah, I also want to ask you real quick, because you did mention it in one of your previous messages to me. It might just be a really quick story. You do have a little bit of a story. I do love Citizen Ruth so much. And you said that you actually did screen this movie, and I want to hear about how that went. Yes, tell me about the screening you did for Citizen Ruth and how that went in your town that you did it in.
Oh, incredible challenge. So in Philadelphia, we have a very, very, very phenomenal art museum called The Barnes. It is a really renowned art collection that was a private art collection that the owner very specifically laid out his collection a particular space outside of the city of Philadelphia. He you know, lined up the art just as he intended, and he put in his last will and testament, like, this is what I want, and I want this art to stay here forever in this location and be open to the public and so on and so forth. It's one of the greatest single art collections just known to man. And there was a very, very controversial decision from his estate and from the museum to move the museum to the city of Philadelphia, right by our art museum, and to build a brand new building and to recreate the building that it was in and his layouts for the artwork throughout. And it's got just incredible pieces by Cezanne and Modigliani and Picasso and all of these incredible artists that he was just collecting at the time that they were making work. And then this collection got to be just absolutely trillions of dollars of art. Where I'm going with this is that they lost the lawsuit. They were able to move this collection to the city of Philadelphia. And in this brand new museum, they put a movie theater in the lower part of it that they barely ever use. But when they were doing opening weekend, they did the most spiffy thing. They said, hey, we're going to be open for the entirety of our opening weekend, every 24 hours a day, start to finish, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. We're going to be open 24 hours a day. So what we want to do is we want to program films in the theater that we're having there so that, you know, it's something for people to do. And so they were like, okay, well, you, and then they were like, well, what kind of films do you want programmed? Because I was working for the time at the Philadelphia Film Society and the Philadelphia Film Festival. And they said, we want, you know, art films. And it was like films about art, films with artistic integrity. And they just went, art films. And I was like, uh-huh. Artsy films, films about artists. They're like, art films. I'm like, great, cool, wonderful. Thank you for that descriptor. So then I realized very quickly that we could do whatever the hell we wanted. And so I was like, great. So we kind of, the team broke it up into shifts of kind of 6 hours that we were going to curate films for. And because, as we've established earlier, I do not sleep. So I got midnight to 6 a.m. for 4 days in a row. I got to program movies in the Barnes Theater in Philadelphia. At the Barnes Museum. And so I was like, okay, art films. And so I just kind of took it as like indie films about artists and speaking out and this, that, and the other thing, created a big list of things I wanted. And I was like, okay, I will do films about artists like Basquiat. And I will do films that are kind of artsy in a way, like Haosu, the Japanese horror film, which I showed to a packed house at 4 a.m. And I just decided, you know what? I really want to show Citizen Ruth. And so I love that film immensely. I think it has a lot to say on, you know, our rights and artistic integrities and so on and so on. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to program Citizen Ruth. The distributor of Citizen Ruth was so incredibly non-responsive, would not get back to us. And it was an absolute nightmare to try to get through. Just eventually what I ended up having to do was to buy a Canadian DVD copy. Because for those of you that don't know, it has been out of print in the United States since like 1999. It's available to stream on like Showtime right now. So if you've never seen Citizen Ruth with Laura Dern, it is phenomenal. And I had to get a Canadian Canadian DVD and project that. That was the way that I was able to do it, because the distributor just was like, oh, no one, you know, wants that copy. Or sorry, nobody wants to that film, and we don't know where it is, and then this, and then they stopped responding. And it was like, oh, this is so much fun. The irony of irony, Alexander Payne's film with Shailene Woodley and George Clooney back in, I guess it was 2011, we did an Alexander Payne retrospective, and we tried to again show Citizen Ruth as that retrospective. And guess what we ended up showing? Shh, don't tell the ticket buyers. It was the Canadian DVD again. So that Canadian DVD of Citizen Ruth is the only copy that I have been able to show in theaters, but I've shown it in theaters twice. What fun. But I love that movie. Everyone go see it. Streaming somehow on Showtime. But other than that, physical copies, you got to go to Canada.
Yes, or you have to go online and get it on Amazon or something, or whatever you want to do. It was last month on both Hoopla and Canopy. So for those who use your library cards, you better be pulling up on that shit, because that's how I watched it. I had watched it before.
Shout out to Hoopla and Canopy. Oh my gosh, the best services. Hoopla, Canopy, and Libby, which you get free from your library with your library card. You log your library card in, and they have hundreds and hundreds of films and books and audiobooks and record. Oh, it's so good. Do it, people.
It's so amazing, yes. And you can get fun movies like Citizen Ruth and stuff. It's great. But yes. So, yeah, no, I deeply love that movie a lot as well. Laura Dern just yelling, what's the matter with you? Are you fucking people deaf? I want an abortion. I just want that intensity in my life in any generation, in any situation. Ever. Oh, amazing. Anyway, so yes. But a little bit about this movie. So, Justin, I'm going to ask you to do a little something for me before we go into figures and all that. So if you had to pitch this movie to somebody who maybe has never seen it and maybe they've never heard of Election, how would you describe this movie to somebody maybe has never seen it?
Election is the story of the type A personality, Tracy Flick, and her attempts to win the student government election running for president as she is thwarted at every turn by someone she doesn't even know is her arch nemesis, teacher Jim McAllister, who is so fed up and her pushy ways trying to get anything and everything she wants that he decides to recruit quarterback of the football team, Paul Metzler, into running for the student government, thinking that surely he will be able to overtake and beat Tracy. And what ensues is an incredible political battle set on the back of a Nebraska high school stage, with lots of twists, turns, bee stings, you know, sexual relations, and all sorts of other fun along the way. And it is very dark and silly.
Yes, yes. Good pitch to those who may have not seen this movie. I like that. So as we normally do in the show, we're going to go into the figures of this movie, talk a little bit about the cast and the crew of it. We'll also talk a little bit about how this movie came to be. And we'll also talk about the differences between the book and the movie, because we have both read this, so that's great. And then, yeah, just chop it up a little bit and do all that. So this movie, Election, came out April 23rd of 1999. So when you're hearing this, it's celebrating its 25th anniversary. So happy birthday, Election. Love that. We're looking at a runtime of about 103 minutes. So it doesn't go into the 2 hours. Thank God. I hope it doesn't. But it gets in, gets out pretty easily. It's nice. This is also on the Criterion Collection. So if you want to go out and get yours, if you love this movie or if you watched it and you really love it, you can get it that way. This is a Paramount Picture. Technically, it was distributed by them, but it was, as Justin said, it was an MTV film. And so either that, I just was talking about that not too long ago, where I think it's so funny that this is an MTV film, because there's other films, you know, that I would think would be MTV films that I just wouldn't expect it to be this. You know what I mean? But yeah, but it's technically distributed by Paramount because, again, Paramount owns a lot. So and then looking at about a $8.5 million budget for the budget of the film. This movie, in terms of box office, didn't do that great generally. So it came in at about 37 on its opening weekend with about $119,000. Again, it's a hard sell of a movie to make because there was just a lot going on in 1999 at this point. So in terms of movies, there's just a lot going on. So I think this kind of got a little lost in the shuffle. And overall, this movie only really made about $14 million, $14.9 million overall. So ultimately, it didn't do the best financially. However, I think it did well critically, though, because a lot of the people who saw it really said, oh, this is something good. Like, this is something that is, it was kind of a launching pad for Mr. Payne and his career. This was also this was nominated for an Oscar, I believe in 2000, for Best Adapted Screenplay. It didn't end up winning, but this is the first of at least two separate times that Mr. Payne and his writing partner, Jim Taylor, would also be nominated. And I believe win for that category, too. They didn't win it this time, but the other times they did win. So that's kind of cool. Looking at about a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's certified fresh, and then about 79% for audiences. Again, those are just an aggregate, but most critics would, I guess, say, hey, yeah, this movie's pretty decent. Go see it. And then the voice of the people on Letterboxd say it's a 3.8 out of 5. Do you have anything to talk about in terms of that box office or like kind of the number or the critical response to this movie that you want to add before we get into cast and crew?
So this came out in 1999, and that was a time where, critics were fairly regional, with the exception of, again, Siskel and Ebert and kind of some of the major publications. And I very explicitly remember reading positive reviews for this from Siskel and Ebert, positive reviews in People, positive reviews in Entertainment Weekly, positive reviews in my local paper. And it was something that I was like, ooh, okay, so I'm going to go see this, MTV film. And I am part of that $14 million, my probably $5. But still, it was something that I went and saw in theaters and absolutely loved. But it is a film that was incredibly lauded for the film's tone and how it very, very, very much walks a tightrope throughout the film on comedy versus, the situation of the narrative. It also got nominated for a Golden Globe, not for Alexander Payne, but for Miss Reese Witherspoon for her performance as Tracy Flick. It had a number of other awards, including a GLAAD award nomination film for the LGBT representation of Tammy, which I think is pretty damn cool. So it had, a large swath of award nominations. Don't think it won too many of them, but it was a film that, for the people that saw it, loved it. I explicitly remember when it came out on DVD and definitely showing this to a lot of friends who had missed it in theaters who really, really loved it. I think 1999 was a great year for, dark films with female protagonists, one of my all-time favorites. Drop Dead Gorgeous also came out that year, which was a film that I saw in theaters that very few other people did. So really, really genuinely, think that this film just kind of got lost because as a teen film that MTV was heavily marketing, it kind of only hit that first weekend of teenagers going to the movies to see it, kind of a little bit more critical darlings and praise that kind of fizzled out too pretty quickly. So I think it kind of got lost, but as we've seen, it's considered a classic, Criterion put it out and it's really, really, just an exceptional comedy.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the reason I wanted to cover it on the show is that even though, yes, I do think it's a classic, it does have a cult following to it, I feel, because this movie is, I think it is similar to Citizen Ruth in its tone, which is very much biting hard edge, if you will. And I also just think like this is a movie that ultimately, even though it did get critical praise, it still didn't exactly do the best financially. So that's kind of a piece of the puzzle when you talk about cult movies. And I also think that this movie was doing stuff where it is dark and we weren't doing a ton of those dark comedies towards teens necessarily like that. I think this is a really good example of it. And then also I think just having something and having the balls to have the LGBT representation of like Tammy Metzler was something where, it was pretty cool to see that. And I think also kind of adds to a little bit of its cult status, if you will. And I think it's one of those movies where the people who really like it really like it, and the people who do not like it like don't like it for the reason that they do. That's fair enough. But yeah, and then so moving on to like our cast and crew, as we already mentioned, we have Alexander Payne, who is the director of this movie. It's his second feature film, and so he then went on to do The Holdovers, which recently was just nominated for Best Picture in the Oscars. He also did Citizen Ruth, The Descendants. He also did Sideways, as I mentioned, a couple different things like that, in Nebraska Man. He and Jim Taylor, his writing partner, wrote this movie based based off of the book from Tom Peralta, which we'll get into. They also, I think, were a part of writing the movie I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, which I've never seen and I don't care to see.
You don't ever need to. It is absolutely terrible. Yeah, it's and Jim Taylor also, let's not forget, wrote Jurassic Park 3. Yes. So, you know, when he works with Alexander Payne, there's some winners. When he goes off on his own, there's some doozies.
Yeah, exactly, for sure. So we also have the composer of this movie, Rolf Kent, who is kind of a man in, you know, he's done some banger movies. He did Freaky Friday with Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, and also Mean Girls and Legally Blonde. So, you know, he has a type of how he likes to do his movies, and that he's, I also think the music in this movie is like really boss. Like, I really like it. It's just, it fits the tone of it very well.
Absolutely. And just a quick shout out, Enjoy the Ride Records recently put out an election soundtrack of the score.
I love it.
I think the score of this film is so much fun, from the choral bits where Tracy, like every time there's a Tracy face crack, there's just this extreme choral music that's played that's really, really fun, and just lots of great strings. But yeah, Enjoy the Ride Records has a soundtrack, and it's available in a red, white, and blue election swirl vinyl. And it's super, super cute and fun. I have it in my collection and highly recommend it to anyone that loves the music of this.
I might just pick up that. I might just do it. Then we have our cinematographer, James Glennon. So I think he's also worked with Payne before. He did work on About Schmidt, I believe, as a cinematographer on there. But I'm sure he's also worked on some of the other projects. That was the big one that I noticed. The editor of this movie is Kevin Tent, which I'm sure he's done some other work as well. But the thing that I noticed from him is he was the editor of the one and only Frankenhooker from 1990. Love that. Which is pretty much a lovely, lovely movie by Frank Henenlotter, which pretty much the joke is that I have not seen Poor Things yet, but Poor Things is the joke of, like, it's just a remake of Frankenhooker, which, you know what, I'll stand by. I'm sure. But yeah,
I was gonna say Kevin Tent got his start making like a lot of direct-to-video sequels of really great films. So he did Basket Case 2, and he did Rock and Roll High School 2, Rock and Roll High School Forever. He did Hollywood Boulevard 2. Like, he just was really like in a very, very specific lane. And then he was able to finally leave the lane because of Alexander Payne, who hired him to do Citizen Ruth. He started doing like actual big tentpole films. He did Girl Interrupted, Blow, J-Lo Monster in Law, you know, all the classics. So really, really great that Alexander Payne was able to identify his talents from such classics as Frankenhooker.
Exactly. Love that for him. Yeah, so, and then we also have to give the shout out of shout outs to the one and only Lisa Beach, who I just worship at the altar of Lisa Beach, because if you don't already know, and you may have heard this if you listen, she has cast some of the greatest teen movies of this generation. This one included, but also she is behind Jawbreaker. She is behind Scream. She is behind a lot of these teen films. She did Citizen Ruth, which is crazy to me, but she did. She's just a banger of a person, and she just knows how to cast people. Her and Sarah, her partner in casting, Kara Katzman or something like that. They're so good. So yes, and this was perfectly cast. We'll get all into that for sure.
And Lisa B, shout out to another great cult film, 1992's Mom and Dad Save the World with Terry Garr and John Lovitz. If you've never seen that one, it is a doozy. Wally Shawn, Kathy Ireland's in it. It's that one's just silly and stupid and should totally be discussed at some point.
Oh my God, we'll do it. I'll put it on the list. So then we have our actors of this film. So we have Mr. McAllister, Jim McAllister, played by Matthew Broderick. He had a day off once. Okay, that's what a lot of people know him for. He also just showed up in No Hard Feelings, which was a great little film with Jennifer Lawrence and Andrew Barth Feldman. It was on Netflix. Really enjoyed it. He played the dad in it. And yeah, I think this was a perfect role for him. We'll talk about how the cast came to be and everything. We then have Miss Reese Witherspoon. I say that she went to law school after her lover got hit by a taxi in New York City. Okay. Yeah. She's just, there's so much about Reese Witherspoon. I love that you liked Man on the Moon. I like that movie as well. It's pretty good. She will always and forever be Vanessa Lutz to me from Freeway, because I think she's fantastic in that movie as well. But she plays Tracy Flick. I'll talk about who else was considered for that role and how I think it would have been also a time. We then have Chris Klein in his film debut, literally, and we'll talk about how he got cast. He really wanted to lose his virginity in another film he was in not too long after this one, and he's appeared in all the American Pie sequels that he was a part of, and I think he does a great job here. He is definitely in the Himbo Hall of Fame for me in this film, for sure. Jessica Campbell, yes. Jessica Campbell is Tammy Metzler. She will talk about what happened with that too, but this is really her only prominent film role she had, and she went and then on to be a neuropathic doctor, I believe. And she unfortunately passed away, I think, in 2020 or 2021 from flu-like symptoms. So don't know what that means. Don't know what happened. Tammy, we love you and miss you every day because, you know, you were awesome. Mark Herlich is just funny enough. You bring up Jurassic Park 3. He is in Jurassic Park 3 as well. But he plays Mr. Novotny, who is the teacher that got fired because of his indiscretions with Tracy. And then Holmes Osborne is Tammy's dad in this movie. He's Mr. Metzler. And he had a daughter who's a cheerleader. Because if you don't know, he is the dad from Bring It On. He's Torrent Shipman's dad. So, yeah. And then I'm trying to think who else in terms of the cast. We also have Molly Hagen in this movie. So Molly Hagen plays, I believe it is, oh, dear God. I think it's his wife. So Jim McAllister's wife Diane.
Mr. Right. McAllister's wife, Diane. Yep.
Yes, yes. So Molly Hagen, it's funny because she is the wife, but she also is in a movie that I recently watched, but I deeply fell in love with from the 80s, Some Kind of Wonderful, with Eric Stoltz and Mary Stuart Masterson. It's so good, and she plays one of the friends in it. So it's kind of funny how the amalgamation of teen movies came about from the 80s, and I just think it's a really smart casting that they did for her, because it just works.
Molly Hagen is a character actress still, and she's still working, and she is very, very, very heavy in TV. She's actually still currently one of the leads in the Walker Texas Ranger reboot that they do with Jared Padalecki. She's in that show right now, but she's been in so many amazing series over the years. Also a shout out to Delaney Driscoll, who plays Linda Novotny, the temptress, who it was an Alexander Payne regular. She was also in Citizen Ruth, one of her few other films, and she is amazing. I genuinely wish that she had done so much more, because she was a fantastic actress, and I really want to give a shout out, especially if I have the privilege of being on a cult podcast, to Tracy Flick's mother, Judith Flick, played by none other than Colleen Camp.
Hell yeah.
Yvette Zimane from Clue.
I'm frightened of the dark. Won't someone go with me? Oh, it's so good. She's amazing.
She's so good.
And she's also the stepmom in Valley Girl. Shout out to another cult film. Love it. Colleen Camp.
Oh my gosh. So many. I mean, that was her career was cult films. Yeah. Wayne's World, Die Hard with a Vengeance. I mean, she has just done so, so much silliness, and we love her, and she's still acting today. And absolutely love her. I want to give a quick shout out to the actress that played Lisa, Frankie Gracia, who she was kind of like an MTV Undressed regular. So anybody of a certain age will remember that show. It was kind of that late night, sexy teen comedy soap opera that was on MTV back in the day. But I first saw Frankie Ignacia in this really shitty, wonderful, made-for-TV movie called The Positively True Adventures of the Alleged Texas Cheerleader Murdering Mom, which has Holly Hunter and Swoozy Kurtz in it. And it is about, cheerleader murdering mom, played by Holly Hunter. It's great. It's so much fun.
I love that, honestly. And then also, quick shout out to, this cast is like awesome, Nicholas D'Augusto, who is his first movie in here. He went on to then be doing acting and all that. He's most notably the lead in Final Destination 5. So it all started with Election, baby. Like, I love that for him.
it is kind of cool that there's so many actors and actresses that are still working today that got their start on this film. Nicholas D'Agosto, Frankie Ignazio, this was her first film. Again, Chris Klein. And Nicholas D'Agosto also has done a lot of TV, Masters of Sex notably, but I want to give a shout out to Trial and Error, which is such a great comedy. And if you haven't seen it, Kristen Chenoweth and another of other amazing actors and actresses, Jemma Mays from Glee is also in it. That one's all streaming on Amazon Prime if you've never seen it.
I love it. I'll have to check it out.
And I guess shout out that this is streaming on HBO Max if people haven't seen Election yet.
Yes, exactly. So if you have an Max subscription, please go watch it for sure, for sure. Yeah, so casting, Lisa Beach did her job well. I mean, what can I say? So we'll talk a little bit about how this movie came about and came to be. So this movie was adapted from a book in particular by Tom Peralta. I got this information from a True TV Inside documentary that they did. Talks about Election, probably in 2016 when the election was happening, or 2020 probably. And so where they actually got Matthew Broderick, Frankie Ingrassia, Jessica Campbell before she died, you know, all of this. Chris Klein, Lisa Beach was there, Alexander Payne. They had a bunch of people come back. Mark Haralick, all that. And they had Tom Peralta on. Pretty much he had, he was a man, an older man, and he saw what the 1992 election was. If this is not a history podcast, but quick history lesson for those, that was when we had Mr. Bill Clinton running against, who was it? I think it was some Republican. And then they had a quick little, just like... the one and only Ross Perot also put his, you know, hat in the ring as well. And it was kind of this crazy election that happened. And he decided like, all right, well, I want to write a story about how crazy this election was. I always think about those elections with the television show All That, which has been in the news because of Quiet on Set and everything like that. And Katrina Johnson was actually on that, talking about her experience being on All That and her experience with Dan Schneider and all that. Her impression of Ross Perot is fucking hilarious to this day for me, where she just talks about how she has $4 billion and she just has this like laugh. It's hilarious. Anyway,
with the giant ears that she has plastic.
Oh my god, the giant nose, the giant ears. She's Ear Boy's friend. It's a whole thing. I love it.
Yeah, it was a whole thing.
It was great. But anyway, so yeah, he wrote and thought, well, I want to write this, but maybe set it in a high school. Why not? So he wrote the manuscript, and honestly, he was like, all right, I wrote this, but nobody was biting. Nobody wanted to publish it. People were like, nah, who cares? And it wasn't until somehow, some way, this ended up in the hands of some producer, I believe, who then gave it over to Alexander Payne and Jim Taylor and were like, hey, because they had done Citizen Ruth. They had done that. It didn't do well either, but they were looking for things to adapt. And Tom found the script and he was like, all right, cool. Let me send it to you. And they were like, hey, this could make a really good movie. This can make an interesting movie. And so that's what kind of happened, which then made the book published in 1998, which then had the movie published in the movie was then released in 1999. So, you know, it was all kind of a happy accident, if you will, because it was just this guy who wrote it.
Which it's so funny that that's what they talk about in the documentary, because it's total revisionist history, because, you know, what had been documented was that MTV, a producer with MTV Films is who kind of got a hold of the script and got the rights to it and tried to give it to Alexander Payne to do. And Alexander Payne said, I don't want to do a teen film. No. And there he said no multiple times before he changed his mind and came around to doing it, which is just so funny because to this day, you know, it's probably his most noteworthy film and that's really stood the test of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you're going to talk about that. Like when you're on a documentary, talk about the movie, you're not going to mention the details like that. But yeah, it really did end up like that. And MTV Films was trying to get itself off of the ground, really. So, you know, they had done Beavis and Butthead, Do America. That had done pretty all right. And they had their hands in some other films. But
was this before or after Joe's Apartment, which will always and forever be, and this was after, so Joe's Apartment will always be my favorite MTV Films film, and that's the one with Jerry O'Connell, who plays a bachelor who lives with a bunch of cockroaches that talk to him and perform musical numbers, and it is an absolute fever dream of a movie, and I highly recommend it if you've never seen it. That one is streaming on the Roku channel. But yes, that's my favorite MTV film that came out before. Their tagline was sex, bugs, and rock and roll.
This came out before. This came out after Joe's Apartment is what that was.
So that was a movie that they, one of the first MTV theatrical releases. And I really bombed. Go figure, because I love that movie.
Yeah, of course. But yeah, I mean, that's how this movie kind of really came to be. And it got into the hands of Alexander Payne, who then brought this around. We will talk a little bit about the book. We can talk about that now. So if you want to, Justin, you can also kind of dive in. So what are some kind of notable differences from the book to the movie? And I can kind of corroborate what you're talking about a little bit, since I also just read it not too long ago as well. But what are some of those differences from the book?
I think what's really interesting in the book versus the movie is Tracy herself. I think the film gives Tracy a little bit more agency over what she's doing and what's happening. And there's a really wonderful scene in the film where Tracy and Mr. McAllister are talking kind of in the third person about, a naive younger person, and an older person. And you can really see that the Tracy flick in the film is completely aware of what she's doing and how she's going about it. Whereas in the book, there are some situations where, things happen and Tracy kind of is either going along with it or using that in an opportunistic manner. What's also interesting in the book versus the film is that there's a huge subplot with Jer. Shout out to Lauren Nelson, who plays the custodian in the film, who was the actual custodian at the high school where they filmed this movie, was not an actor. And as such, they did not have the extended role that he had in the book as they did in the film. In the book, the custodian actually is the landlord of Tracy and her mother's home. Tracy and her mother are both kind of much more on the poor side. Which is why she works, so incredibly hard to do so many things. Also in the book, it is well known that Tracy and her teacher, the head of the yearbook staff, had an affair. Whereas in the movie, it is something that is just between the administration, Mr. McAllister, of course, knowing because it was his best friend and Tracy. And so in that way, a lot of characters act and react very differently to Tracy, because in the book, they treat her as a little bit more of kind of a sexual object. Like, sure, males will make fun of her because she is, this really like try hard kind of character. Larry, who is Nick DeGasto's character in the film, is just absolutely in love with her. They talk about her body and the way that she is in certain outfits and looks and this, that, and the other thing. Whereas the film doesn't do a great job establishing Larry's love of Tracy, and which comes back kind of at the big reveal of the election fraud at the end of the day. So when it comes to the book overall, there's a little bit more with Tammy and Lisa. There's a little bit more of Tammy kind of, being very conscious about the decision she makes because she's trying to get thrown out and sent to the all-girls Catholic school because there's another girl there she likes. So there's, a number of different kind of subplots and things that are there. But what I will say is that overall, other than some of the changes in, the tone and tenor of Tracy's character and the way that other people treat her, the movie is a very faithful script to the book itself. And I think, as you really expertly established, this screenplay was crafted before the book even ever came out. So there's definitely some chicken and egg influence scenarios that could be discussed and dissected. But that being said, they are very, very similar, and also just both incredible, enjoyable experiences. I genuinely recommend people checking them out. And I will, at the end of the podcast, give a little bit of information about the sequel, Tracy Flick Can't Win, that just recently came out and supposedly is getting adapted into a film. But we'll talk about that.
Of course, yes. So thank you so much for that comparison. I'll also add on top of it as well. So also in the book, Mr. McAllister and his wife do not separate. They don't. They end up staying together. She does not kick him out of the house and like leave his ass. they actually reconcile and they get together. And then guess what? They have a baby. So that is what happens in this. Very different from the movie. Also, the other thing is that at the near the end of the movie, when Mr. McAllister is kind of dejected and he is fired pretty much from the school, there's a scene right before where Larry, played by Nick DiAugusto, actually, you see it in the movie that Nick is driving and he sees Mr. McAllister and he spits at him. He spits at his car onto his car window. He actually spits in his face in the principal's office or wherever the fuck it was. So that actually happens in the book as well. And then also the other big thing with the book is that there was actually an alternate ending to this film where Mr. McAllister actually was working at a used car lot that one of his students was like the son of the manager or owner of it, pretty much. That's where he's working now that he's been fired as a teacher and everything like that. Miss Tracy Flick comes over before she goes off to college to actually buy a new used car, and they have a whole conversation about would you have really let like Paul really run and like he would you let him actually like rule and all this blah da da da, and you actually find out so the Metzlers are not the Metzlers in the book, they're the Warrens, so it's Warren Cement or whatever. And you find out that actually, similar to how Justin was talking about, so the janitor of the school is the landlord and everything. He cuts them a really good rate with rent and everything because they can't afford to not have that. But anyway, so what happens is that they take a test drive in the car that Tracy's thinking of buying for her graduation gift. And she drives over to her house and leaves Mr. McAllister in the car while she runs inside or whatever. And she brings out her yearbook from her house. And what we find out, and this was actually shot in the movie, we find out that Tracy actually lives right next to the Warrens or the Metzlers cement plant. So every day of her life since she's been living in this town for however long she's been living in that house, she's had to be reminded of the fact that she does not come from privilege. And that's probably why it really grinded her gears that like Paul Metzler or Paul Warren was the one that like was tasked to run against her. And then also funny that Tammy also threw herself in there too. It's just, and they shot the whole movie. They shot that alternate ending as well. That was the original ending they shot because it was more faithful to the book. However, with test audiences and just some of the people who saw the ending, they kind of were like, oh, this just isn't in line with the rest of the movie pretty much. And so that's why we have the current ending of what it is now, where we have Mr. McAllister moves to New York. He becomes a tour guide at a museum. He dates a new lady in New York and he sees Tracy one more time in Washington, D.C., where she's working for a Republican senator or whatever as an aide or whatever when she had gone to Georgetown, which is right. Well, I don't live in D.C. or near D.C., but whoop whoop D.C. But so that's a little bit of the differences of the book. Do you have anything to add on to that before we get into a little bit more of the production history?
And that alternate ending that was created for the film of Tracy working for the Republican, that was the allusion to, again, the character. Tracy was supposed to be the George H.W. Bush / Bob Dole character. You know, we've got Chris Klein being more of the Bill Clinton, the fun-loving, that character. Then you've got Tammy being the disruptor, the Ross Perot character. So her ending up working for a Republican in the end was just kind of like the wink, nod, nudge, nudge. Did you not notice that she was supposed to be George H.W. Bush? Well, now here, let's just drive it home.
Absolutely. So that's a little bit about the books, movie differences. If you read the book, you pretty much have watched the movie and vice versa. There's just a little bit differences, but as a fan of this movie, I really did like my read of the book. And I am interested to maybe read Tracy Flick Cannot Win or Can't Win. I'll maybe put it on my reading list. Anyway, back to the production history. So, all right, cool. They're going to make this movie, right? So Alexander Payne wanted to do it in Nebraska, where he shoots a lot of his movies. They were like, all right, yeah, cool. Let's do that. Because it was actually set in New Jersey, the book is set there. But he wanted to do it in Nebraska. He was like, all right, fine. As you do with a movie, this is a lower budget movie, technically. But, you know, you're trying to find a cast, right? So they got the green light. All right, cool. We're going to make this movie. It's going to be great, right? At first, when they were looking for Mr. McAllister, they kind of were like pitching people who literally Alexander Payne was like, no, are you fucking kidding me? Like they wanted to get like Tom Cruise or like Brad Pitt or this other person or whatever. And he was like, no, none of these people work. Like, are you kidding me? Like, absolutely not. Until they came across Mr. Matthew Broderick. And I think it's so perfect because Matthew Broderick, being that he was Ferris Bueller in his, and it's what he's most known for, it'll be on his tombstone in his obituary and everything. But like, for him to be this character of like rapscallion, kind of like wink, wink, you know, like at the camera, he talks to the camera in this movie, all that, right? For him to go from that to then be this kind of bored with his life, just like going through the motions teacher, it's like him becoming the Ben Stein character, or even I guess maybe the principal character in a way from Ferris Bueller. I just thought that was so interesting to me, and I think it was a very good choice. And honestly, I don't know who else they could have gotten that would have been perfect for that role. I think this is, out of a lot of what I've seen of his, it's his best role to me, like, honestly. Do you have anything to add to that?
With Matthew Broderick, I mean, I had the privilege of getting to see him in The Producers on Broadway, just an excellent, excellent live performer. And I really love that he took this opportunity to return to his teen film roots. But as you said, on the opposite end of the spectrum, in a teacher, educator, administrator role. And I really, really love how he plays Mr. McAllister. I mean, you know, the entire lesson about morals versus ethics, which I'm sure we can talk about later, the delivery of that, where he is just so engrossed in trying to get it out of these children and trying to, you know, make sure that they, as young adults, have these fully shaped minds and understand the difference between morals and ethics. And then, you know, the comedy of it cut to moments later when he's talking to a fellow teacher who doesn't understand the difference between morals and ethics. And it's just a real, you know, slap to the face that this is the world we live in. But he plays the entire film very wide-eyed, very hopeful, and a lot bubbling below the surface. It's an incredibly restrained performance, but also a lot of comedy and physical comedy. And I really, really appreciate, you know, what Matthew Broderick brought to this role. And I agree with you. Absolutely perfect casting. Tom Cruise could never.
Absolutely not. Not way whatsoever. Then we go into Miss Tracy Flick. So there isn't a whole lot of other people who were considered for the role. However, this is a very important role. I think what had happened is that Mr. Payne had seen Miss Reese Witherspoon in a little movie called Freeway. But had also seen like Man in the Moon and like all this, and like thought she was great and everything. I did find out, at least from IMDb trivia, so take it with a grain of salt, but I think it would have also been good casting. One lady by the name of Melissa Joan Hart was considered, and I think even auditioned for the role. And personally, listen, if you don't already know this, Melissa Joan Hart is a Republican and, you know, all of that. So, you know, and we still, I like her. Like, I like Sabrina. I listen to her little podcast every so often, you know, all this. Personally, I mean, Reese ate with this role, obviously. I would not be mad at a Melissa Joan Hart Tracy Flick, really, especially with the juxtaposition of her being Sabrina the Teenage Witch and then playing this character that is, and plus also Melissa Joan Hart comes off to me as like a type A personality anyway, so it kind of would just be, it would make sense. But again, Reese 8, I don't know who else really could have done this role, but I wouldn't have been mad at MJH, I know.
I think Melissa Joan Hart would have been an interesting choice if she pulled it off. I think this could have been a different trajectory for her career. I genuinely think that if Melissa Joan Hart had gotten this role and had pulled it off at the level or near the level that Reese Witherspoon was able to, I genuinely think she would be having a very different career right now. That being said, it is always so funny to me that Melissa Joan Hart is a Republican because it's a situational thing. She grew up in like the reddest part of New York, which ironically is right across from Fire Island. Like I pass by, I literally go to like Melissa Joan Hart's hometown to go to my little gay destination every time, like the ferry leaves from her super Republican hometown. That I think is very funny. So yeah, she is a Republican, but it just was, you know, how she grew up. So nature versus nurture.
Yeah, totally. But I also think, like I said, Reese 8, like once they saw her, and it's crazy because then like she ended up having this movie, you know, Cruel Intentions the same year. Then she hit it big with Legally Blonde. I mean, girl just had a good she had a good end of and then into pre and into the millennium, I guess. So for sure. And then also with
don't forget she also had Pleasantville. That was
you're right.
Huge cultural phenomenon at the time.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. And then we have to talk a little bit about Tammy. Because these are really our three big main characters, I would argue. If you don't already know this, everybody, Jessica Campbell was not the first choice for this film. So a young lady by the name of Miss Thora Birch was initially cast in this role. She was 15 years old when they did this. And what had happened was, well, she and Mr. Payne had a little bit of, differences of opinion on how they approached this role, all of this, blah, 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 blah. And so what ended up happening is that she quit / probably got fired off of this role. And then they were looking to see who else they could have gotten. And then actually Jessica Campbell put herself on tape and she sent that in, and that's how she got cast, which is kind of crazy. But yeah. Do you think you can tell me whatever you want to about the whole Thora Birch of it all? Do you feel like there's anybody else that would have been in Thora Birch's caliber that could have done this role as well? Even though Jessica Campbell ate, I'm kind of wondering, like, who else could have been a name that could have done this role, maybe?
So I just bemoan that we didn't get Thora Birch in this role. I mean, Jessica Campbell, this is her role. She made it her role, and she will always forever be Tammy. I mean, frankly, the film only got the GLAAD nomination for Best Film because of her and her role of Tammy. I mean, she really, really nails this and gives fantastic representation at a time where there really wasn't as much. And I genuinely, you know, am so glad we got that performance. But oh my God, Thora Birch would have killed this. If you had to give me, the reins, who would I have cast in this role as Tammy at that time that could have done it? Brittany Murphy.
Oh, absolutely. Wait a minute. You up? Yep. Yep. I think it would have made sense. It could have, worked. Yeah, put her in everything.
I mean, but just going by me, Brittany Murphy could have just read me the phone book. I think she was just a wildly talented actress gone far too soon. But I think Brittany Murphy could have pulled off Tammy for an actress of that era. But that being said, Thora Birch, just a phenomenal actress that I have so much love for another cult film, Ghost World, which is one of my top 10 of all time.
Yeah, I like Miss Thora Birch. I feel like, she seems like an interesting duck. You know, she's doing a lot of conventions nowadays, you know, going off of like Hocus Pocus, that and Ghost World and just everything, all this. She was asked about Election at like a convention she did a panel at. She didn't really delve too much into it because I don't think she can technically, but she liked being on the set, I guess. She thought it was cool, but it just was difference of opinion with her and Alexander Payne. So, but I completely agree.
And she had already shot, I believe the legend has that they had already shot 3 days with her in the role and then went back and reshot with Jessica Campbell. So there had to have been something that really went wrong, because there's plenty of times where casting gets changed before people actually get on set, but for them to actually have footage in the can and then to get rid of someone, that doesn't happen too often.
Yeah, I agree. And then also the whole thing of, like, I think the rumors is that, like, some people say that Thora Birch is a little like unhinged or like whatever. Listen, if you were a child actor like that, I feel like you wouldn't have everything, every duck in a row either. But she seems fine. Like, she doesn't seem that bad. You know, anybody could say that about anybody, really. But I like Thora Birch for what she is. I wish she had more roles currently. I think she's a really fascinating actress and, you know, gotta love her for being in Now and Then, right? You know, why not? Ooh, wait a minute. Not that she would have done it whatsoever, but who knows? A Christina Ricci could have been interesting to see in this movie somewhere. I don't know. We'll have to see. I don't know. But yeah. Anyway. And then also talk about Chris Klein as well. So Chris Klein, for those who do not know, he obviously is Oz from American Pie. But before that, he actually was just a gentleman who was living in Nebraska. He's not from there, but he grew up there. He I think came in his high school years or something. I think he's from Illinois or something like that, in Illinois, Indiana somewhere. But his family moved to Nebraska. He was a local high school student in the area, not the high school that they shot, but instead was at another high school in the area. And he had just graduated, I think. But what happened was that Mr. Alexander Payne was walking around a location scouting for this movie in particular. And what happened was he came across this guy who was coming out of a weight room or something. He had done sports, but also had done some drama stuff as well in high school. And he just left an impression on him, not in a weird way, like not in a, you know, pick me type of way. I think it was more so like he met him and he was like, oh, like you could actually be really good for, like, you know, maybe a role I'm thinking of. Like, he just left an impression on Alexander Payne where it just works, I guess. And it was a thing of like, they were not sold. The powers that be, I think Alexander Payne was sold on Chris Klein, but the powers that be were not, because he is not a name. So, but the thing is that I feel like I don't know who else could have played this. I'm sure we could have gotten some kind of wide eyed and bushy tailed, like himbo person that could have played this. But I think Chris Klein did a really good job at this, because yes, he is a little dim, the character is in general, but he's also very well meaning, which I really like. And I just think this was a fantastic debut for him. Is there anybody in particular you would think could have done this role that would have been a quote name, if we're thinking of like the executive producers who weren't sold on him, that could have done this? But again, Chris Klein also ate in this film. So, and it's crazy to think that like this movie came out and then a couple months later, literally one of the biggest teen movies of the time came out and he's also in that.
If I had to cast this role, it's one of those things where it's hard. Hindsight being 2020, you know, knowing someone, the trajectory of their career and how famous they are now, but we're acting in teen stuff at this time and bridging teen to adult stuff. Honestly, Ryan Gosling, I think could have done the gosh and shucks that the role requires. But I think that is what is so exquisite about Chris Klein's performance, is that he really is able to deliver blank slate in the face with just that you know, homegrown, honest to goodness, corn-fed smile that he's giving you with everything that he's doing. I mean, from his election speech, which is read monotone off of page, to the way that he delivers the voiceover, just matter-of-factly about, you know, blowjobs and penis size and sex amongst everything else. You know, it's just really, really an exceptional role and debut. And the fact that, you know, he is still acting today, you know, years and years later. I mean, he's got that Netflix show Sweet Magnolias that he's on, and he was on that CW show The Flash up until I think the pandemic. So I mean, you know, he's still in the industry, and it's just really, really great that someone came out. I think they also just announced that he joined the cast of the new Fear Street movie, also for Netflix. So I'm kind of excited about that, and hoping that, similar to Matthew Broderick, we're going to get him in a perhaps teacher or administrator or parent role, since he made his debut in a teen film. So would love to see that get flipped as well.
Yeah, I would love that. I haven't really heard much about that, but I would be super interested in seeing that. I at least saw the first Fear Street. I don't think I've seen the second and third, but I'll get around to it. I know people are kind of like hot and cold on those series, but they've got to be better than that stupid Goosebumps show that came out. I mean, come on now, let's be real. You know, listen, God, I hated that show so much. It was not good. Please do not watch that at all, listeners.
I can't believe it got a second season, but they announced that they cast David Schwimmer in the second season. So I'm like, okay.
Oh my God. 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 I'm leaving all that in, because like, I just can't. That show sucked so bad. Anyway, so like, anyway, but it's, you got me gooped, Justin. I can't deal with you. Anyway, but it's all good. Oh, anyway, so back to happier times. So yes, Chris Klein ate in this role. Love that for him. And they shot this in 97, right around Halloween time. So October to December, I think, fall time. And they spent a literal year and a half like editing it, which is crazy. And then they released it and everything. And yeah, so I mean, not too much crazy production history. They did have to use, they could not shoot right in the Omaha district because the school that They were going to try and use, would not allow them to. So they did have to go right across the district lines and use a school there, which also fun little thing. And I only know this from your review on it on your Letterboxd, is that shout out Terry Menard from Gaily Gentle and Scarred for Life. He went to that high school and is an extra in the movie, which I just think is really funny because of course he would. Like, why wouldn't it be?
I know, such a small world kind of a thing. I've genuinely paused the movie and tried to zoom in and look for him in some of those big scenes that he said he's at. And I haven't found him yet, but just really, really cool to know that someone that I know and love is an extra in this fantastic film. And it's also interesting, again, when we're doing the comparisons between the book and the film, the book isn't set in Nebraska. It's not set in Omaha. And that's something that is very specific to Alexander Payne, that he tries to set so many of his stories in Omaha, Nebraska. I mean, hell, he has a movie called Nebraska. I mean, he is so incredibly in love with his home state and wanting to do, you know, constant love letters and to show people that it's not just a flyover. So I really, really respect directors that try to continuously showcase the best of, you know, where they're from or their area. Shout out to Philadelphia in every single Shyamalan film. Hey.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And then also, I mean, come on, like I live in Baltimore, like this is John Waters' country and really because of me. Amen. So like, you know, it's just like, but it's so cool to see your city like on screen. So I can understand for people, you know, and yeah, why not? If I was doing that same thing, hell yeah, I would. It's boring seeing like LA all the time. Like LA's not even that cool from what I understand. You get what I'm saying? Like, I don't need to see it in every single goddamn movie. It's more fun when things are shot on location anyway, because it's a different look. It's a different feel. And it also can feel really lived in too, which is always really nice, as opposed to being on a soundstage, which of course you're going to be. But like when you can shoot on location, you have actual locations. I think it makes the movie that much more interesting to watch, really. It's a little bit about the cast, the crew of it, how the movie came to be, the books and all that stuff. Yeah, so I guess if anything, we're not going to go through plot stuff because we already kind of did. And I guess if anything, are there any particular, like, you know, scenes or anything that kind of sticks out to you in regards to kind of the overall, you know, the scenes of the movie, or like anything that you kind of want to touch upon that you want to look into, dissect?
Sure. I think a lot of what works about the film is it's kind of the frank nature of sexuality and sex and how it's discussed in a way that, you know, isn't expected of teens, let alone of adults, alone of Nebraska. You know, and there's a lot of really great smash cuts that do that, where we're kind of at one point in the film and it goes somewhere else. I mean, you know, we've got Mr. McAllister giving us the voiceover about Tracy, and we get the thing about Tracy is, and then it cuts to Mr. Novotny saying, her pussy gets so wet, you won't believe it. And that's kind of the first time in the film that we're cued in. This is going to be like, oh, okay. You know, you just had some, you know, woman in an independent theater somewhere clutching her pearls and going, I can't believe I just heard that. You know, the film doesn't pull its punches when it comes to, you know, how it discusses sex and sexuality. And I really do appreciate that. I think it really sets up really well at the beginning, a dynamic between Mr. McAllister and Mr. Novotny and what their friendship is. So that knowing that Tracy was the person that ultimately led to his best friend, his colleague, and their downfall, that now affects his life, is something that really, really weighs on him. And I think that's established really well, really early on in the film. They do a really great job showing that Mr. McAllister, you know, he's won Teacher of the Year 3 times, and, you know, they show actually how he is in a classroom situation. And I, you know, Matthew Broderick does a really, really good job in establishing that he's just inherently a good person that believes in teaching and in what he's doing, and that he wants to leave his students with these morals and ethics moving into the future. So I really, really appreciate, you know, how the film opens and establishes its frankness with sex and sexuality, especially when we then move on to meeting Tammy and Lisa, who, you know, are in flannel and making out to some female singer-songwriter. I mean, it doesn't get more Lilith Fair 90s lesbian goddess goodness than that. And I really, really love their introduction.
Yeah, I can agree. I think setting up Mr. McAllister's life, I think, is done very well. And it is very frank of how it, you know, handles that as well. I also, like, I would say, if anything, One of my favorite scenes of this film is the speeches of the film, because it really sets up each character for who they are. And it's a very clear, they are what their archetypes are. You have Tracy, who's the type A personality, who, you know, has this very specific speech that she, you know, delivers. It's Chris Klein's character, Paul, who really is just like, he's well-meaning, but he's not all upstairs in the head. And, you know, he's really just reading it monotone wise. And I just think that's like so very well done. And I think Chris Klein kills it doing that. And then also just Tammy doing her speech, because she is that wild card where she's just kind of putting it out there and saying like, none of this even matters. And I would just dismantle the student government and all this. And I think that that scene in particular is really one that people come back to, because it is just showing these different kind of different types that are within the political sphere, you know. And I think that's really well done, and I think it's very it's pretty cut and dry with that. But I do like that. I'm trying to think of anything else really. I also do like the scene with Tracy pulling down all the posters and just ripping them down, because if anything, it just shows that, and having read the book too now, and having the background that she does not come from privilege, she does not come from money, and she's just so type A, she just has this like perfectionist quality to her, which, hey, shout out, you know. But like, it's this thing of it's one of these things where she accidentally rips down one of her own posters or something, and then now she's just like, well, fuck it, you know. And so she just, it just like makes her like rage, you know, and it just shows that she's a teenage girl at the end of the day. And, you know, teenage girls have rage just like anyone else does. So I think that was really an interesting scene as well, that I think just kind of captures a lot. And then I also just love how,
oh, I was going to say, actually, and one of my favorite scenes is what results from that. I mean, when we have, you know, Lisa and Paul that come in to talk about the posters coming down, and how, you know, we're going to want another election because we need posters. We have to have posters. We need election with posters. And just, you know, the fixation of, you know, this Midwest high school on that's what's going to win them the election is posters. That the exchange that Mr. McAllister and Reese Witherspoon's character Tracy Flick have going back and forth is really, really one of the most dynamic scenes, where they're talking completely in, you know, obtuse third person about the relationship that Tracy had with Ms. Novotny, of you know, Mr. McAllister's own relationship, when Tracy flat out calls out Mr. McAllister for being unable to get his wife pregnant, which is something that is so incredibly like jaw-droppingly different than anything we've heard come out of Tracy Flick's mouth or from her voiceover. Like, that really showed that this is somebody that will do or say anything to benefit her. She genuinely thinks that she is going to get caught for having torn down his posters, and is fully prepared to, you know, lean on her mother, who is a paralegal at a law firm in town, and do all these things and makes all these threats. So then when Tammy comes in saying that she knows who took down the posters, Tracy thinks Tammy has her and has evidence against her, which does. Tammy has every single one of the Paul posters that she tore down, except she takes credit for it because she wants to get kicked out so that she doesn't have to go to that terrible school anymore and can go to be a nice lesbian and all-girls Catholic school. So it's this really, really great you know, character beat where we get to see her go head-to-head with Mr. McAllister. And I think genuinely this is where they both take the masks off, and where they both discuss very, very frankly, you know, who they believe the other to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also just love how like Tracy just literally, once she sees what Tammy's done, instead of being like, hey girl, thanks or whatever, or just like kind of having that idea in her mind, she's just like, you're gonna pay for my poster. She's just like caught up in the delusion of it all, in a way. But what I also like about this movie too, and because I'm a fan of hashtag not everyone needs to be likable, you know, I think that nobody in this movie is a reliable narrator. Nobody is. And it's, I think that's just so fascinating to me in a movie like this, because it's so interesting too, that like, we're supposed to think of Tracy as the villain, quote unquote, right? And but honestly, when you think about it, yes, she is annoying, I guess. She's type A, I guess. At the end of the day, she's not really the villain of the piece. Yes, she's annoying. Yes, she's kind of a shrew, blah, 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 right? And Reese Witherspoon has even said, like, oh, it kind of hurt my career a little bit. Be a Reese Witherspoon girl, like, you'll be fine. But, like, you know, people thought she would be a shrew. Like, they didn't want to cast her being in that and whatever. I think that she ends up being more sympathetic than Mr. McAllister ever will be. Because at first you feel for him, you're like, okay, cool. Like, yes, I understand that, like, you've kind of just grown bored with your life. And we kind of see that as time goes on. But, okay, cool. But then, in no way, shape, or form does he really, to me at least, he doesn't really redeem himself, honestly, really anyway, because, yeah, dude, nobody told you to try to sleep with your friend's wife, you know, and nobody told you to try to, like, ruin this girl's life, you know what I mean? Like, you're kind of the villain of the piece, which is so funny because, like, you're not supposed to think that of this teacher, but, like, no, he's trash. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just, yeah. So I like that there's no reliable narrator. I think that's very interesting and a bold choice.
I think you hit the nail on the head. A lot of people will watch this film and will say Tracy is the villain of this film, when in all actuality, let's zoom out. She is a teenager. Like, is she a bitch? Yes. You know, is she opportunistic? Is she doing whatever she wants to get whatever she wants? Absolutely. But she is a teenage girl. What teenager doesn't think that the universe revolves around their sphincter? It's not like she's any different than the rest of us were at that age. Tracy Flick is not the villain. The villain is, are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? Gasp. Middle-aged, cis, white, heterosexual men. You know, I think Mr. McAllister and Mr. Novotny, you know, both, if we're looking at this as a metaphor for elections, you know, it's not any of the candidates that are evil. It is the election process. It's the electorate, a.k.a. the people counting the votes and casting them that, you know, are corrupt and a system that's broken that allows this to happen. And I think it was very, very interesting, you know, in the metaphor of the film, looking at that George H.W. Bush versus Bill Clinton versus Perot election, that really wanted to say, like, hey, look, all of these characters all have their own motivations. All of these candidates all have their own motivations for whatever reason. But that being said, I'm with you 100%. I don't think like the villain of this film at all. I don't think she ever has been. And if you think that, you should probably take a look in the mirror a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of these things where, yeah, it's just, and I kind of like that, you know, nobody here, like I said, is reliable, and it kind of just feels true to where, yeah, this is just high school, and high school is important for the time that it is, I guess, for the people in it. But at the end of the day, it's all a bunch of BS. Like, it's all like, we're, it always feels like, you know, oh, it's going to something further, going to something to your future, blah, da, 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 da. This will go on your permanent record and all this. And not saying education's BS, but, like, the drama of it all in high school is all BS, really. You can't get caught up in it because it's not going to be a part of your life once you leave it. You get what I'm saying? And it's interesting that when Tracy thinks, oh, I'm going to go to Georgetown and I'm going to be around, you know, like-minded people. No, you're going to be around a bunch of rich kids who, you know, some of them are cool. And then some of them are like you. And you end up finding the people who are like you, being somebody who went to a private college and can also understand that, like, yeah, that's an absolute thing that happens. So, you know, it is what it is. It's not what you think of it as when you're in high school. I also think it's interesting because, yes, Tracy is also not exactly the most likable all the time, but it's also just funny to me. It's absurd, really. Her destiny, for her, it seems like, is to be the student body president. You know what I mean? That's what she thinks her destiny is.
Interfere with destiny. That's why it's destiny, which exactly is such a great direct quote that we get from her at the offset of the film. Yeah, she believes that her destiny is to win the student council election and then go on to live her successful life as the women like Elizabeth Dole and Connie Chung, who are name checked.
Exactly right. But yeah, I just think like that's such an interesting, that's an interesting fight going on in the main conflict we have. And to be honest, I mean, even with the current ending that it is now, I think it is in line with the film, but I have seen the alternate ending and I actually really like it. I think it is something where you get to see like why Tracy is the way that she is. And I really bang with that. And I think it's just a nice, it's just a nice little thing, but I understand why it didn't work maybe for the movie, but it, I think is actually a nice ending to that. Do you have anything to kind of talk about in terms of, do you think there's anything in this movie that does not maybe work that kind of falls a little flat perhaps? And then we could also talk about after that, maybe talk a little bit about the just legacy and cult status that this movie has had.
I think there's a real imbalance in some of the characters. And I totally understand that, you know, as you said at the onset of this episode that we're recording, you know, you don't want the film to be more than 2 hours long, but there's certain characters that certainly suffer as a result. You know, we don't get the janitor as he was in the book. We don't get as of Larry and really understand his relationship with Tracy. We don't get nearly enough of Tracy's mother, which how dare you cast Colleen Camp and then don't give her to us? How dare you? But I genuinely, you know, think that there are some interesting things. You know, Alexander Payne chose to shoot this and to set this in the great state of Nebraska and not in, I believe, New Jersey, where the book takes place. And so in doing that, there is in the film characters that are referencing God, which of course we all know that religion's a little bit bigger in the Midwest than it is in this you know, wonderful Northeast heathen hellscape that you and I live in. But that being said, it's really interesting because we first meet, you know, have the discussions of God from Chris Klein's character when he said, I was really mad at God when I broke my leg. And then later we actually have this really wonderful juxtaposition of Chris Klein's character, Reese Witherspoon's character, and Jessica's character, you know, Tammy, Paul, and Tracy, when they're all praying to God and they're all praying for very, very different things. You know, we've got Tracy who's praying to, you know, win the election and to move forward on her destiny. We've got Paul who's just, you know, praying for things to go well and thanking God for his above average penis. And then we've got Tammy, who says, "Dad, I know I don't believe in you, but I'll be starting Catholic school soon, so I thought I should practice." And then goes on to hope that God shows Lisa what a bitch she is, and wants Paul to win over that cunt Tracy. Then she wants leather pants and to be friends with Madonna. And it just was so wonderful and interesting, you know, kind of juxtaposition between these characters. But I think it's really interesting if you're going to move your film to the Midwest and you're going to bring up God, you know, I think it being done in a half-hearted way and not really kind of having it as an undercurrent throughout the film, I thought was kind of interesting and didn't work, other than that one scenario where we got to see the three different characters and their relationship with our Lord and Savior, Alanis Morissette.
Well, for me, it is also Dolly Parton for me. Excuse me, how dare you? But, you know, it's all good.
I was referencing a fellow 90s film, Dogma, in which Alanis Morissette plays God.
I love that. Also, love that Reese Witherspoon also went on to play an angel in Little Nicky. Good for her. But yeah, I completely agree with what you're saying. I think, like, I wish there was more with these characters a little bit. I would have loved to have seen a little bit more fleshing out of some of these other characters as well. I would have loved to have seen Nick D'Agosto have a little bit more to do, especially since they do talk about that more in the book and really how much he's in love with Tracy and all of that. I would have loved that a little bit more. And yeah, like, that is one of my favorite scenes, is the kind of praying scene or whatever. And I think that that's really, it kind of also similar to the speeches, I think it just kind of shows these characters for who they are and what they're doing. I firmly stand by Tammy Metzler, of course, being the heathen atheist that I am. But I just think that, you know, it's also just very funny and darkly comedic, which I just think is very funny. It's in a different way though, and I really appreciate, this is why this and Simbus and Ruth are just like set in, I feel like, a similar environment. Technically, I think the hardware store that Mr. Novotny works at is the same one that Ruth Stoops goes to, which I think is very funny because there's that whole thing. I do think like there's that little bit of there that does not really work, but overall, I think this movie works pretty well. And I think just like the legacy this film has had, some people may argue if it's a cult movie or not, but I do think it is. But I think it's gone on to be a kind of teen movie classic. This is one of Barack Obama's favorite political movies, apparently, if not his favorite. I personally also think that Dick is a fantastic movie too, but that's just me and my gay self. But, you know, whatever.
We love Dick on this podcast. Huge fans of Dick.
Oh, I love it. Love it. Both in the literal sense and also in the movie sense. Put Kirsten Dunst and Michelle Williams in more comedies. Damn it. Anyway, so... But yeah, no, it's that kind of thing. But I also just think this does such a good job at satirizing politics in general. And I also just think, like, it takes the kind of ridiculousness of a high school election and is able to really try to say some really interesting things there. And I think this film is a little bit too smart for some folks, maybe, perhaps. It didn't work for every single person, but... it was not your average teen comedy, really. It wasn't your average teen film, really. So I think that's also adds to its kind of legacy and its to its cult status, is that this is not something, this is not She's All That. This is not 10 Things I Hate About You. You know what I mean? But it doesn't have to be, and that's fine. And I'm always down for a movie that does not, it is off the beaten path, and that, you know, is not afraid to be itself. And that's why I think I really bang with it. It's in my top four in Letterboxd because I just really like it, dude. Like, I can't help it. Like, it's just a good one. I spent money on the Criterion. Like, it's a banger of a film, personally. Do you have any, like, closing thoughts on Election, your Jerry Springer thoughts on it?
I just think that Election has such an enduring legacy in cinema just because it really, really, I think, was one of those fantastic bridges that showed that the teen movie, which I think had really devolved throughout the 90s, could really have a lot more to it, that there could be a really, really great undercurrent to what was being shown and said in the film. I agree that, you know, some things might be going over the head of certain teenagers, some, you know, might not actually enjoy the film. But as a teen myself that saw it, I just absolutely loved how dark it was, how sardonic and witty the film is, the way that it showcases these characters. Absolutely has cult status. I have gone to see retrospective screenings of it and had lots of people who've shown up in Tracy Flick sweater vests. So, you know, the fact that they are kind of getting that kind of really, really great, you know, love from the film and people that are coming to see this. I mean, Tracy Flick, again, misunderstood. She is a strong, powerful woman. And I think it is such a great example of how strong and powerful women are treated in our society. That they are made to be bitches, that considers her a cunt, that this is a character that so many people that watch the film will think is the villain and will despise, when in all actuality, you know, she is somebody that, more so in the book than in the film, it's shown is, you know, impoverished and is a woman and was taken advantage of by another teacher. And so she is going to fight tooth and nail to better herself and to better her future and better her position in this world. And I admire Tracy Flick and the Tracy Flicks of the world who are just so misunderstood because all they're doing is fighting even harder to get what some people are just handed. And that is what I think is one of the enduring legacies of Election. And I just really, really, really love the film. And even though I didn't love Tracy Flick Can't Win as a book, I'm very excited to revisit the character.
Beautiful. Love it. So yeah, I think that's a good way to end on this. But I want to thank you so much, Justin, for coming on the show. If you want to talk a little bit about what you thought of, you had your news about Tracy Flick Can't Win. If you want to share that a little bit as well, even though you didn't like it as a book, but if you want to share that as well, but also plug yourself, plug your social media, anything you're working on, all that good stuff.
So first I'll talk about Tracy Flick Can't Win. For those who don't know, Tom Parada, out of nowhere, just in 2022, decided to drop a sequel to Election. Then it was announced that there would be a sequel film that would star Reese Witherspoon and be directed by Alexander Payne, that is supposedly going direct to Paramount Plus. I will believe it when I see it. I have heard nothing about it in a little bit of time because that was announced, my gosh, I think end of 2022, early 2023, and then nothing's really moved forward on it. So again, with movie news, you take everything with a shaker of salt. But Tracy Flick Can't Win. It's wonderful spending time with Tracy again and spending time with Tracy as an adult. But there are so many direct correlations between the original film and text and this one that it kind of gets a little groan inducing. So Tracy actually went to law school, and then in law school had to drop out to come and take care of her mother who got ill. So she ends up moving home to her home state. She also moves home because, shocker, she sleeps with one of her teachers at law school and gets pregnant. And so she decides to keep the baby. And so she is now a single mother living back in her hometown. She took care of her mother until her mother's passing and is now raising her daughter. She becomes vice principal of her school. And she is a vice principal there. And it she finds out that the principal is leaving and she is up for the principal position. However, the school board wants to hire a successful former football coach for the role instead of her. So it is about her and this football coach kind of duking it out for the principal position of the school. There's some subplots about, you know, recognizing people for a person of the year, an alumni kind of a award. And then there's a really, really poor taste, late kind of twisty, shocking thing that happens that is, I think the movie may not get made. So go into it with a shaker of salt. I didn't particularly love it, but again, I did like spending time with Tracy and I liked how she grew and evolved as a character. So that was really great spending time with her, but the book doesn't stay in her narrative in the same way that it did in Election, the original book bounces around between narrators, so does Tracy Flick can't win. So when you're spending time with Tracy, I'm enjoying my time with Tracy. When I'm with other characters, they aren't as great. And so it's a little bit of a challenge to get through. And then again, there's something that happens towards the end of the book that I won't spoil, a bit of an eyebrow raise. You can make the judge for yourself when and if that movie is ever made, or you can check out the book on your own.
All right. Good to know. And then also you can plug your social media if you want to as well.
Plugging my socials, my first initial last name on Twitter, because I refuse to call it the other thing. So J-N as in noise, O-R-D-E-L-L. And then I am Mogwai47 on Instagram, if you want to come say hi to me there. I am also Jane Ordell on Letterboxd. And again, you can read my new movie reviews in Philadelphia Rojo Magazine. We are digital as well, if you want to check those out from wherever you're from. And again, shout out to the wonderful podcast Scarred for Life with Terry Menard and Mary Beth Andrews. Terry, who is an extra in this film. I got to guest on their Tremors episode and talk all about my childhood trauma surrounding that film. And I've had another of other wonderful guest appearances, such as Cinepunks. I got to talk about Drop Dead Gorgeous and Killer Workout. Harqueers talked about Funny Games. HKHS, I talked about Last Unicorn, all of these phenomenal cult films, which is why I was so excited to come on your podcast that I have enjoyed so, so much, just because it is a topic that I'm so passionate about. And thank you for really highlighting and spotlighting all of these phenomenal films that should be on people's radars, but because of their cult status, sometimes they fall by the wayside. So you are doing the Lord's work here.
Yes, thank you so much for that. Oh my God, such a glowing review. But thank you so much for that, Justin. And I hope to have you back for sure. We'll have to figure out what you might want to come back for. But this has been a blast. But thank you so much. And to plug myself, so you can follow the show on Instagram at Cult Cinema Circle. Twitter is Cult Cinema Circle. Letterboxd is Jesse, J-E-S-S-E-K-R-E-M-P, all one word. Go look at my stupid reviews I have, my lists, all that fun stuff. I am not a journalist. I have no bylines anywhere, but it's all good. I think that's everything we can, to talk about with Election, but thank you all so much for listening. Please rate, comment, subscribe. Put me on, put me on the radar, everybody. Leave me a comment. Leave me a review. Give me 5 stars. All that good stuff. So thanks for watching and listening. And remember,
you can't interfere with destiny. That's why it's destiny.
Exactly. Thank you all so much and take care. Bye.